Well, Wayne, I'd like to thank you for coming on and being our guest today. If you would introduce yourself briefly, then I'll ask you a few questions.
My name's Wayne Purdon. I've been a staff member since 2009 or 2010. And I live here in Glendale, Arizona with my wife, Julie, and occasionally our two daughters, Athena and Hespera.
Well, thank you, Wayne, very much. And Wayne, could you tell us some significant events that happened in your childhood?
Yeah, I was born on April 27th, 1948, the second child of Beatrice and Alfred Purdon in Plainfield, Connecticut. Both of my parents worked in factories, and my grandmother helped raise me. When I was two, my father re-enlisted in the Navy to join in the Korean War effort. When he returned, I still didn't see much of him because he was either working, bar hopping, or sleeping. So my father basically taught me what not to do through his bad example. I feel strongly that by helping to birth me, he was paying off a life debt he incurred in a past life. So I'm grateful for that and for teaching me what not to do. So I didn't have much male influence in my upbringing, but I did have a few uncles who were good role models, and I also had 10 aunts. So I had a lot of cousins. Some of my aunts helped to take care of me and my sister. With so much influence from my mother, grandmother, and other mother figures who were devout Catholics, including nuns, in my elementary education, I developed a strong devotion to Mother Mary. At one point, I thought about becoming a priest, but something stopped me. I think I had been a priest or a monk in previous lifetimes, and that my plan for this lifetime was to marry and raise children. The point at which I thought about being a priest was a traumatic event that would change my life and put me on the spiritual path. I was usually an obedient child, but one cold spring night when I was nine, I was lying on the carpet in front of our stove. My grandmother told me to get up and go to bed. I was too comfortable and tired, so I ignored her and pretended to be asleep. She lost her temper and pulled the rug out from under me. I then went to bed. The next morning, she went to the hospital, and within a day, she had died. I asked my uncle what she died from. He said that she had an aneurysm, and it burst, causing internal bleeding. I asked him what would cause an aneurysm to burst, and he said that it could have been overexertion. I then realized that I was the cause of her overexertion. I felt extremely guilty and dared not tell anyone, not even the priest in confession. But I started to pray a lot for forgiveness. At the time my grandmother died, my mother, who was pregnant, had a miscarriage and I lost a baby brother. Around this time, my parents got divorced, and my father soon remarried, and I was introduced to my stepmother and her daughter from a previous marriage. In a year or so, my father and stepmother had a daughter. So I had a full sister, stepsister, and a half-sister. I wasn't interested in girls during my preteen and teenage years, but I understood them and respected them. My first date was at my senior prom. My stepsister, who was a freshman and had a crush on a senior, wanted to go to the prom with him, but her mother said only if I also went and chaperoned. So I agreed to ask someone out so that my stepsister could go. My date turned out to be a professional dancer and impressed everyone with her moves. So that was my high school years, my childhood up to my high school.
Well, thank you, Wayne. So when you left home and went to college and started working, what teachers and experiences further shaped your spiritual development?
Well, I didn't date much in college, but continued my interest in spirituality. I joined a lay order of Our Lady of Mount Carmel in my freshman year. But by my sophomore year, after taking a couple of philosophy courses, I started to become more interested in Eastern religion and less interested in Catholicism. I became the president of the philosophy club and invited speakers on Vedanta, New Age thinkers, hypnotists, fundamentalist preachers, and an eclectic mix of topics. I developed the philosophy that all religions contain some truth, but no one religion has all the truth. One course on the existence of God impressed me. During the course, we argued about Kant's, James, and other philosophers' reasoning for the existence of God, and our instructor showed all the holes in our logic. At the end of the course, he told us why he believed God existed. He said that the similarity of near-death experiences in people from different cultures and religions is the undeniable proof that God exists. At the end of my junior year, I enlisted in the Peace Corps college degree program at sunny Rockport and joined dozens of idealistic youths from all over the country. I still wasn't dating, but became close friends with some of the female volunteers, who I suppose trusted me because I didn't ask anything of them. I tried dating one after our psychologist said it wasn't normal not to have sex, but it didn't work out. She was a devout Catholic, and I would go to Mass with her, but at one service, the priest said that we needed to grow up spiritually and not depend on priests as mediators between us and God. I followed his advice and never went back to another service. Around that time, I was attending a Gurdjieff study group. The study group leader invited me to their commune near Lake Canandaigua to meet his guru, Helena Marsh, who had been Gurdjieff's secretary for several years. I went and was impressed. It was one of the reasons I decided to drop out of the Peace Corps program and not finish my degree. That summer, I worked on the commune on weekends and had a job at a restaurant in Rochester during the week. Mrs. Marsh seemed to know what was going on in my life without me telling her. At one point, when I was working in the hot sun with a woman within sight of Mrs. Marsh's window, the thought popped in my head, "Why don't you take off your shirt?" I answered myself, "Because it would be unfair to my female coworker who couldn't take off her shirt." When we stopped to go to lunch, Mrs. Marsh came up to me and said, "I noticed you working in the garden. Why didn't you take off your shirt?" And I started to explain why, and then said, "That's funny. The same thought occurred to me." She then smiled and nodded with a knowing look. I thought, my God, she either communicated with me telepathically or read my mind. This made me uncomfortable, and I soon left New York in search of less threatening gurus. I first went to Baba Ram Das's commune near Taos, New Mexico, but I didn't like the regimentation. Then I went to Santa Ana, California, to visit Robert Durop, my favorite philosopher and author of The Master Game. He saw right through me and called me a Dharma bum, saying I was escaping from my Dharma and needed to go back home and balance karma. But he gave me the option to stay there and join his commune. It was tempting because he told me I was the exact same type as Kali, a commune member who I soon met and felt strongly attracted to. She was a hippie flower child, and I could tell she was attracted to me also. But after tossing and turning most of the night, I decided to go back home. I then spent the next 4 years working in a factory job, finishing my degree in environmental earth science, and balancing karma with my parents. I still maintained my interest in Eastern philosophy and religion and went to New York City to hear Sant Kripal Singh, who gave me my first experience of deep meditation in which I saw my aura. I desired more of it, but didn't desire to become his disciple. But on the way back home, I decided to look into transcendental meditation. I soon was initiated and experienced more deep meditations in which I saw my aura. I became a meditation checker and soon was off to Italy for my first course in becoming a TM teacher. When I returned, I helped out at the teaching centers for a couple of years and returned to Austria to finish my teacher training. During these years, I got a job with the U.S. Geological Survey and got accepted into graduate school at Ohio State University. I didn't initiate too many people, but I did join the TN City program in which I learned several cities or powers, including levitation. It was more of a thrusting energy from the base of the spine rather than a steady energy. So I would go up and forward for a few seconds, but come down. So I had to do it on mattresses. I left Columbus to join the Advanced City Program at Maharishi International University in Fairfield, Iowa, until my money ran out when I went to a course in India. While in India, I lost 20 pounds and almost died when I contracted bronchitis and dysentery at the same time. Fortunately, a French doctor gave me antibiotics. I returned still sick with only $50 in my pocket. I could have given it to a beggar woman in New Delhi who lost her home and all her possessions in a flood. I regretted not giving it to her, but years later I sent $50 to CARE, specifying that it go to a poor woman in India. I soon got a job washing pots in the MIU kitchen. After about a year of that, I had the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. to join the staff at a retreat center there. When I was in the Advanced City Program, I had read in the Srimad Bhagavatam that a devotee of the Divine Mother who faithfully meditated on her name, Bija Mantra, for 9 years, could ask her for any boon and it would be granted. My TM mantra was various forms of Saraswati's Bija Mantra. I arrived in Washington shortly before my 9th anniversary of my initiation. So on my 9th anniversary, I went into a deep meditation on Saraswati and asked her for a good-paying job. A few days later, I got a job as a technical writer and editor, making $20,000 a year, which was quite a lot back in 1981. It was the equivalent of earning $52,000 per year now. But I blew it. I could have asked for enlightenment. I didn't seek first the kingdom of God, the consciousness of God.
Well, thank you very much, Wayne. And how did you find the teachings of the Ascended Masters?
Well, I worked at my job in D.C. and continued the TM City program for 2 years until I went through a period of spiritual aridity. During this time, I studied astrology under a student of a famous astrologer, Barbara Waters, and saw that a significant change was about to happen in my life. But I didn't know exactly what. I thought about maybe going back to the church, but on the way to see a priest, I stopped to visit a naturopathic doctor who had a huge picture of Archangel Michael in his office. It reminded me of an angel who appeared to me in a vision and showed me the future 7 years earlier, on the night before I decided to go to Austria. I desired to know more about his religion, and he invited me to the Sunday service at the D.C. Summit Lighthouse. I attended and soon became a member. Years later, two of my visions came true at Camelot and at the ranch. A few months later, in early September of 1983, I had experiences of light and darkness that convinced me of the reality of the Ascended Masters and angels. First, I attended a lecture by one of the founders of the Finhorn community, R. Ogilvy Crombie, who had the ability to see elementals and angels. I rode my bicycle in a rainstorm to the church where the lecture was being held, making intense calls to Archangel Michael to surround me with an escort of blue lightning angels. When I entered the vestibule of the church and signed the guest ledger, I turned around and Mr. Crombie was walking up the stairs from the basement lecture hall, looking all around me with wonder. At the beginning of the lecture, he said, "Good evening, ladies, gentlemen, and angels." A few days later, I attended another lecture by a leader of the TM organization who was rumored to be a black magician. Because I felt protected by angels, I had the crazy thought of confronting him about that and jumped up on the stage after the lecture. His aide intervened and scheduled an appointment for me to meet with him, which I never kept. After the lecture, I went to a restaurant with some friends. While we sipped our drinks, my bottle of Perrier rose in the air and moved a few inches to hit me in my hand and settled back down on the table. Everyone saw it. I didn't feel anything because I was protected by my tube of light. I should have made protection calls and decrees because later that night I woke and couldn't move. Above me was an inky black cloud that was slowly descending. I couldn't even scream, but after a great effort, I was able to utter one word, Astraea. Immediately, I was freed and could move. It was around 4 a.m., so I decided to get dressed and go to the D.C. Teaching Center to pray. While there, I learned that Elizabeth Clare Prophet would be coming to Washington for an emergency prayer vigil about the shooting down of KAL Flight 007 by a Russian jet. During the prayer vigil, I prayed to El Moria for an opportunity to meet Mother, something everyone said was impossible. But I surrendered it, and due to a series of unusual events, I met and talked with Elizabeth Clare Prophet and felt a strong bond from past lives. I decided to go to El Moria in Kuan Yin's quarter at some university in December of 1983. I stayed for the following quarter on the ranch and then went stumping on the East Coast. When I returned, I joined staff at Camelot for a short time, then went to the ranch for 7.5 years. During my years on staff at the summit, I spent a lot of time doing physical, mental, and spiritual work. At one point during the shelter cycle, I was working about 14 hours a day and neglecting my spiritual practices. But during the trial in 1986, I was praying about 14 hours a day, so I guess it balanced out. During these years, I also exercised my mind and my spare time and wrote short stories, a novel about the American Revolution, and an allegorical novel about the initiatic path.
Wow. Thank you, Wayne, for your wonderful stories. And I see our time is just about at the end. Our 20 minutes is suddenly shrunken to about 1 minute left. So in that time, could you tell us, Wayne, what was the most difficult challenge you have ever faced?
Yes. In 2001, we moved to Austin, where we became involved with the summit. And in June of 2003, I was diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We decided to move to Arizona, but before we left, I heard a recorded dictation of Mighty Victory through Mark Prophet, which gave several healing techniques, one of which was sun gazing and sunbathing. I began doing that every day, and shortly after I arrived in Arizona, I found the teachings on sun gazing through Hira Rotan Manek. I invited him to Arizona and organized several lectures. I founded the International Sun Imbiber Society and wrote 10 issues of the Sun Gazette newsletter. By 2005, my CLL was stable and not progressing and has remained dormant ever since. We tried to join the summit in Phoenix. There were two teaching centers. One was very orthodox and fanatical, and the other was just orthodox. I didn't feel at home with either one, and they both thought that sun gazing was crazy and against the master's teachings. But fortunately, soon after that, I found the Heart Center, which had embraced sun gazing probably a year or two before I found the Heart Center. So I felt very at home with the Heart Center, and I knew some of the members like you and Robert and David, Nancy Frainer, and others. So I felt I was at home, and I've been at home spiritually ever since.
Well, thank you, Wayne, so much. We're glad you're home. We're glad you're here with us at the Heart Center, and we certainly have enjoyed hearing about your events, your spiritual path, and where it took you and how you got here. That's so very interesting about how each of us has different and somewhat the same spiritual path of moving through different phases and then all coming together here at the Heart Center. So thank you again, Wayne. Thank you very much for being with us, and maybe we'll get to talk with you another time.
And thank you for inviting me.
You're certainly welcome. Okay, bye for now.
Have a good day.
Thank you.